You know, when I was growing up, we couldn't say the name of Nelson Mandela. We couldn't speak about Madiba. And certainly not about Biko, not openly, not publicly.
These are people that people we in the community used to think of as our brothers and sisters or uncles who had been separated from us. And we used to not only listen to their music, but we also used to remember them. Like some of the people at home who were fortunate enough to witness Miriam Makeba's performances. And that was a way of, we have a tradition of oral history. So that was an opportunity for our elders to teach us about the reality of our lives in South Africa and the trajectory of our lives under the apartheid regime.
Now, when I came to varsity, which was sometime in 1966, in my own analysis and that of my friends, there was some kind of anomaly in this situation where whites were in fact the main participants in our oppression and at the same time the main participants in the opposition to that oppression. It implied therefore that at no stage in this country were blacks throwing in their lot in the shift of political opinion. The arena was totally controlled by whites in what we called totality of white power at the time.
Rhodesia, a colonial slave state established during the halcyon days of the British Raj. A quick glance at the modern world map, however, attests that the powerful colony would eventually assert the right of self-rule, that from the belly of Rhodesia, the independent nation of South Africa would be born. National independence, however, is not synonymous with freedom. The systemic enslavement of South Africa's people continued long after the establishment of its sovereignty. Was it possible that the oppressed could set a new standard for freedom fighters the world over? In the face of modern technological warfare, could they succeed? And if so, how, without the gutters of Johannesburg running red with blood? Stephen Biko, a soon-to-be martyred activist, Desmond Tutu, a Catholic priest, and Nelson Mandela, an imprisoned social activist, would inform history of a new process of emancipation. Together, they would prevail upon the state and the world to recognize humanism as the true basis for national sovereignty and demonstrate a method whereby, for the first time in history, the slaves would free their masters. Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer. This week, the Pacifica Radio Archives from the Vault brings you the stories of three heroic South African leaders woven together by the songs of Mama Africa Miriam Makeba and the recollections of Pacifica's own Eva Georgia and Bridget Ramazzotti, women who grew up in South Africa under apartheid. From the Vault presents the inspiring story of South Africa's struggle for freedom, social justice, truth, and reconciliation. South Africa, a lesson of freedom.
So we argued that any changes which are to come can only come as a result of a program worked out by black people. And for black people to be able to work out a program, they need to defeat the one main element in politics which was working against them, and this was a psychological feeling of inferiority which was deliberately cultivated by the system. So equally too, the whites, in order to be able to listen to blacks, needed to defeat the one problem which they had, which was one of superiority. So then in 68, we started forming what is now called SASO, the South African Students Organization, which was firmly based on black consciousness, the essence of which was for the black man to elevate his own position by positively looking at those value systems that make him distinctively a man in society. First of all, we were of the view that this particular country is almost like an island of Europe in Africa. If you go throughout the whole of Africa, you do find aspects of African life which are culturally elevated throughout the continent. But in this particular country, somehow, any visitor who comes here tends to be made to believe almost that he is in Europe. He never sees blacks except in a subservient role. And this is all because of the cultural dominance of the particular group which is now in power.
Now, to what extent have you been successful?
Well, we've been successful to the extent that we have diminished the element of fear in the minds of black people. In the period, you know, 63, 64, 65, 66, black people were terribly scared of involvement in politics. The universities were putting out no useful leadership to the black people because everybody found it more comfortable to lose himself in a particular profession to make money. But since those days, black students have seen their role as being primarily to prepare themselves for leadership roles in the various facets of the black community. And through our political articulation of the aspirations of the black people, many black people have come to appreciate, in fact, the need to stand up and be counted against the system. There is far more political talk now, far more political debate, and far more condemnation of the system from average black people than there have ever been since possibly 1960 and before. I'm referring here to the whole oppressive education system that the students were talking about. And after complaining about this, police, in fact the government, wants to further entrench what the students are protesting about by bringing in police and Saracens and dogs almost soldiers, so to speak. Now, the response of the students then was in terms of their pride. They were not prepared to be cowed down, even at the point of a gun. And hence, what happened, happened. Some people were killed, and these riots just continued and continued. Because at no stage were the young students, nor for that matter, at some stage their parents, prepared to be scared. Now, everybody saw this as a deliberate act of oppressive measures, you know, to try and cow down the black masses. And everybody was determined equally to say to the police, to say to the government, we shall not be scared, you know, by your police, by your dogs, and by your soldiers. Now, this is the kind of, you know, lack of fear one is talking about, which I see as a very important determinant in political action.
Since last June, something like 400 young blacks were killed.
499, actually.
499. Mm. And you think that this will not be a deterrent?
No. I think it has been a very useful weapon in merging the young and the old. I mean, before then, there was obviously a difference in the outlook of the old generation to the younger generation. The younger generation was moving too fast for the old generation. The old generation was torn between Bantustan politics on the one side, old allegiances, which were not progressive allegiances, you know, to groups like ANC, PAC, without any resultant action. And there were those who were simply too scared to move.
You condemn Bantustan leadership altogether?
Yes, of course. We condemn Bantustan leaders, even the best of them, like that.
Well, just say a few words on that.
Well, our attitude here is that you cannot, in pursuing the aspirations of black people, operate from a platform which is meant for the oppression of the black people. Now, we see all these so-called Bantustan platforms as being deliberate creations by the nationalist government to contain the political aspiration of the black people and to give them pseudo-political platforms to direct their attention to. Now, men like Gacha Buthelezi, Matanzima, Mangope, and so on, are all participants in the white men's game of holding the aspirations of the black people. Now, we do not feel it is possible in any way to turn such a platform to useful work. We believe the first principal step by any black political leader is to destroy such a platform and destroy it, and, you know, without giving it any form of respectability. So once you step in it, once you participate in it, whether you are in the governing party or the opposition, you are in fact giving sanctity to it. You are giving respectability to it. So in a sense, people like Gacha Buthelezi, like Matanzima, and like Mangope are participants in a white man's game. and they are participants at the expense of the black men. And they are leading black people to a divided struggle to speak as Zulus, to speak as Xhosas, to speak as Pedis, which is a completely new feature in political life of black people in this country. We speak as one combined whole, directing ourselves to a common enemy, and we reject anyone who wishes to destroy that unity. Yeah, we are, as I was saying, of the view that we should operate as one united whole towards attainment of an egalitarian society for the whole of Azania. And therefore, any entrenchment of tribalistic, racialistic, or any form of sectional outlooks is abhorred by us. We hate it and we seek to destroy it.
Chocha means the men are dancing. In Xhosa, they have a tradition of young boys who go off into the countryside. They go through different rites and rituals and they emerge as men.
Blacks have flexed their muscle a bit and they now know the degree of dedication that they can find amongst their own members when they are called to action. And they now know the kind of response they will get from the various segments of the population, the youth, the oldies, and so on. And the second lesson, of course, is the response from the government and the white population at large. The government responded in one way, and the white population also in another way. One doesn't want to get into details here, but you know, reading newspapers, you get some kind of idea of the extent of fear that was prevalent in white society at a particular time, especially just after the first onslaught in Soweto, where there was a real fear throughout the community, throughout the country. Nobody knew just where something would happen next.
So how will these lessons express themselves in future?
I'm of the view that any recurrence of disturbances of that nature can only result in more careful planning and better calculation, thereby achieving the desired results to a greater extent than the spontaneous situation we had last year, for instance.
And you believe that by these means you will bring about a real change of the society?
I see this as only an expression, one form of an expression of discontent inside. I'm of the view that the whole change process is going to be a protracted one in this country. It depends entirely on the degree to which the nationalist government is prepared to hold on to power. And my own analysis is that they are wanting to hold on to power and fight with their backs to the wall. Now, conflict could only be avoidable if they were prepared to avoid it. Those who are at the seeking end, that is, those who want justice, who want an egalitarian society, can only pursue their aspirations according to the resistance offered by the opposition. And if the opposition is prepared to fight with their backs to the wall, conflict can be avoidable. Now, we as BPC, I am a member of the Black Conscious Movement. I was a member of BPC before I was banned, and now I have been, I'm told, appointed as honorary president of BBC. Now the line that BBC adopts is to explore as much as possible non-violent means within the country, and that is why we exist. But there are people, and there are many people, who have despaired of the efficacy of non-violence as a method. They are of the view that the present nationalist government can only be unseated by people operating a military wing. I don't know if this is the final answer. I think in the end there is going to be a totality of effect of a number of change agencies in operating in South Africa. I personally would like to see less groups. I'd like to see groups like ANC, PAC, and the Black Consciousness Movement deciding to form one liberation group. And it is only, I think, when black people are so dedicated and so united in their cause that we can effect the greatest results. And whether this is going to be through the form of conflict or not will be dictated by the future. I don't believe for a moment that we are going to willingly drop our belief in the non-violence stance as of now. But I can't predict what will happen in the future, in as much as I can predict what the enemy is going to do in the future.
People felt separated from their uncles, from anyone that was in exile. So you couldn't help but remember those people who were in exile as you're going through your day-to-day, you know, activities. So we all knew that Mandela was imprisoned, and we knew that it was an unfair imprisonment, you know, imposed or enforced by a racist government. So the issue of politics and race and Mandela, those were all intertwined. When you got on a bus that said blacks only, you became political because then you were reminded of your place in society. And people prayed for Mandela in their buses and trains. There was a train called Shosholoza. Well, it's a song about a train called Shosholoza. And on this train, people used to sing every morning when they would be going to work. And they would sing songs, you know, church songs, but they would also remember Mandela and Biko and Miriam and Sisulu and many other people whose freedom was taken away from them just plainly or simply because of their political views.
So that for meaningful change to occur, there needs to be an attempt at reorganizing the whole economic pattern and economic policies within this particular country. PPC believes in a judicious blending of private enterprise, which is highly diminished, and state participation in industry and commerce, especially on industries like mining, gold, diamond, asbestos, and so on, like forestry, and of course, complete ownership of land. Now, in that kind of judicious blending of the two systems, we hope to arrive at a more equitable distribution of wealth.
But you see a country, clearly you see a country in which black and white can live amicably, yes, on equal terms together.
That is correct. We see a completely non-racial society. We don't believe, for instance, in the so-called guarantees for minority rights, because guaranteeing minority rights implies recognition of portions of the community on a race basis. We believe that in our country there shall be no minority, there shall be no majority, there shall just be people. And those people will have the same status before the law, and they will have the same political rights before the law. So in a sense, it will be a completely non-racial egalitarian society.
But will the vast number of blacks, after all their experiences,
yes,
be able to live a life without giving vent to feelings of revenge, of
yes, we believe it is the duty of the vanguard political movement which brings about change to educate people's outlooks. I mean, in the same way that blacks have never lived in a socialist economic system, they're going to live to learn to live in one. In the same way that they've always lived in a racially divided society, they've got to learn to live in a non-racial society. They've got many things to learn, and all these must be brought to them and explained to the people by the vanguard movement, which is leading the revolution. So that I've got no doubt in my mind that people, and I know people in terms of my own background where I stay, are not necessarily revengeful, nor are they sadistic in outlook. Now, the black man has got no ill intentions for the white man. The black man is only incensed at the white man to the extent that he wants to entrench himself in a position of power to exploit the black man. But beyond that, nothing more. And we don't need any artificial majorities, any artificial laws to entrench ourselves in power, because we believe once we come into power, our sheer numbers will maintain us there. So we do not have the same fear that the minority white government has been having all along. which has led to these many laws, you know, designed to keep them there.
As you know, the main argument of the government is always that the black man just isn't on a civilizational level at present to pull his full weight politically.
Yeah.
And now, do you think of a one-man, one-vote franchise?
Yes, we do think so, entirely. Entirely one man, one vote, no qualification whatsoever, except the normal ones which you find throughout the world.
And you think that the black man, in fact, is perfectly well able?
The black man is well able, and the white man knows it. I mean, the irony of that kind of situation is that when the white government negotiates so-called independence for the so-called trans guy, they don't speak in terms of a qualified franchise. And the trans guy, every trans guy votes, you see? And you get white nationalist politicians arguing that this is a system which is going to work for the trans guy. But somehow, when it comes to the broader country, the blacks may not vote because they don't understand the sophisticated, you know, economic patterns out here. They understand nothing. So they need to operate at a different sort of level. Now, this is all nonsense. It is meant to entrench the white man in the position in which he finds himself today. We will do away with it altogether. There will be a completely non-racial franchise, and the black and white will vote as individuals in our society.
Riots used to break out all the time. There would be tear gas and rubber bullets and violence. And I think the height of that was 1976 when the students, you know, took to the streets in protest against the apartheid, oppressive white South African government. I don't know if you've ever seen, I think they call it the migration of the wildebeest. All other animals, when the wildebeest are migrating, run because they can feel the vibration of the earth from under their feet. And on that day, my best example, it felt like the wildebeest were migrating because the ground was shaking. Bullet shots were just ringing out in the air. It was dark. People were screaming. Rocks were flying everywhere. And pipe bombs and the tire necklace, people were having tires being put around their necks, being set on fire. It was really a crazy time. I just remember the smoke, the screams, the gunshots that were ringing out throughout, and just the vibration. Because that many people were running, students especially, you know. And something told me as a little girl that this is really bad. Something bad is happening, and I will never forget that. So I can only imagine for those people who are my seniors now, who helped to fight for our freedom, who made it possible for me to be here today as a, you know, as a free individual, as an equal, as, at least in the eyes of those that oppressed us. So 76, June 16 was the catalyst to everything else that happened after that, because then in the 80s and in the 90s, when President Mandela was released, there was the same energy, but in a positive way.
The issue here is not one of armed struggle. It's a question of apartheid. The issue is not one of sanction, but one of repression. The armed struggle was resorted to by us because we had no other option. There were no peaceful channels open to us to prosecute our struggle. And as long as that position remains the same, we have no other option but to continue with the armed struggle.
Mr. Mandela, you called for a broader black unity. Could you spell out, please, exactly what this means with regard to non-charterist organizations?
Well, unity between the ANC and its allies and other political organizations in this country is already in the process of taking place. And I think that the CDF conference, which was held at the University of Philippi, is an indication of the progress that is being made in this direction. The ANC has, throughout its history, made the question of unity amongst the oppressed people a top priority. And it is continuing with that task. And I think that the foundation has been laid and progress is being made in that direction.
Ms. Mandela, your statements on nationalization were received rather unfavorably, not only internally, but in international communities. Is it likely that the stance, the anti-stance on nationalization could alter?
That may say a great deal about the reluctance of whites inside the country and in the West to achieve a real settlement in this country. Because the whole agitation is misconceived, especially when you have in mind the history of this country. Nationalization has formed a part and parcel of the history of this country. Now, for them now to be agitated over our demand for nationalization of certain sectors of the community shows that they are not yet ready for either the negotiations which we feel are necessary or for a completely democratic system of government.